I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. So glad you could join us here on the Ideas Network. We're changing gears just a little bit here, and we're going to be talking with two members of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center here on the UW-Madison campus. John Greenler is the Director of Education and Outreach Programs for the GLBRC, and he's here every other month or so. Hi, John. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here, Judith. Thank you.
And also, David Rothamer is an assistant professor in the UW Department of Mechanical Engineering and affiliated with the UW-Madison Engine Research Center. Thanks so much for coming today, David.
No problem. I'm excited to be here.
We're glad to have both of you. And, you know, it's so great. We have folks from the Bioenergy Research Center here every month or two, and the topics just vary so much. I mean, it really shows how collaborative the efforts are, and it's kind of amazing. I mean, John, you are, you know, as the Director of Education and Outreach, you really have to kind of put all the pieces together. Last time when you guys were on, you were here with an entomologist. Today it's a mechanical engineer. How does all this very different research relate to the other work within the GLBRC?
Sure. At GLBRC, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, we're really looking comprehensively at how to develop sustainable biofuels, essentially from beginning to end, from plow to pump, so to speak. And so, you know, we really start off in the field thinking about, you know, what are potential future crops for biofuels? How are they going to work in the landscape, you know, at a very large scale to, you know, what are those specific crops going to look like? Can we breed varieties of crops? And then all the way, you know, to conversion of those plant materials into potential fuels. And then clearly, you know, the opportunity we have here today in our discussion is to think about how are those fuels going to actually run in our cars and move us and our material goods around.
So when we talk about biofuels, what is the range of materials that we're talking about? I'm guessing ethanol is the most common and probably the most widely used at this point.
Yeah, good question. So trying to get from biomass, from all this plant material, to actually, you know, driving a vehicle around, you know, the logical intermediate is a liquid fuel. And clearly today that's, you know, gasoline or diesel. But there are really a very wide range of different types of chemicals, different types of compounds that we can use for that. Within today's framework of biofuels, ethanol is really the most, you know, common form in this country. There are other places, in, you know, in the world where biodiesel is common as well. But really, you know, there's a lot of flexibility there. And we can make ethanol from lots of different types of materials. So clearly, here in the United States today, most of that's coming from corn grain. But we can actually make ethanol from agricultural forestry residues, from perennial crops such as switchgrass. Mm-hmm. We can, as we look further down the road, we can use other types of compounds as well. We can actually make, you know, biofuels from these types of residue materials that would end up looking like biodiesel as well.
And it's interesting that you said that, you know, some of the main sources for ethanol are food crops like corn. And I know that's a big concern for people about what it does to the global food prices, and especially for people that are trying to live off of those really basic grains. But the fact that there are other non-food sources for ethanol seems like it would be a big area of interest.
Yeah, really, the vast body of research that we're involved in is looking at what types of biomass can we utilize that really get us out of that conundrum of food versus fuel. So, you know, we're talking about agricultural residues, for example. There's much of the plant that's left over after we harvest the corn grain would potentially be available for making a biofuel. It's this what we call a cellulosic type material. It's this fibrous plant material that's largely made up of this polymer called cellulose, which is really made up of many monomers of sugar, of glucose, which can be converted into a number of different types of fuels. So frequently, I think it's clear we need to leave some of that to return to the soil to really maintain soil health. And that's part of, you know, the sustainability consideration. But I think it's pretty clear we could be taking a portion of that residue material, we call it corn stover, a farmer would call it that, and be able to make it into a biofuel.
Well, and it sounds like maybe there are other parts of the plants that are maybe harder to get as much of the materials out of. So it might be an issue of better efficiency and less waste and things like that.
Yeah. How can we efficiently, economically convert these materials into liquid transportation fuels is really a significant portion of the research of GLBRC.
So let's actually move over to David Rothamer. Your work on combustion engine design is also involved with efficiency. what, first of all, what happens in a combustion engine for those of us that might not get under the hood very often?
Well, we can kind of break it down a little bit based upon the two types of main engines that we currently have in the marketplace. And those would be both your spark ignition engine, which is the predominant engine that's available, as well as diesel engines. And in a spark ignition engine, essentially what we're doing is we're bringing a premixed air-fuel mixture into the engine cylinder, and right now that's gasoline and air generally, and then we compress that mixture up to elevated temperature and pressure, and then actually use the spark plug to ignite a flame kernel, and then that flame actually propagates throughout the engine cylinder over some time duration. In a diesel engine, you have quite a bit different scenario where you actually only are bringing predominantly air into the engine. You might actually also use some recycled exhaust gases as well to control emissions, and you might do that on a spark ignition engine as well. But in a diesel engine, you essentially bring in air, and then you compress that mixture, again, up to a high temperature and pressure, in this case, actually to a higher temperature and pressure than you would in a gasoline engine, and then you inject the fuel through an in-cylinder located fuel injector at very, very high pressure into this hot air mixture, and that fuel then is designed to readily auto-ignite. So it starts basically spontaneously combusting after it mixes some with the air, and you get what we call a diffusion flame that then burns the fuel in the cylinder.
And so why are combustion engines so commonly used? Are they just the best way to move things forward?
Well, the engine, if you look at kind of the history of it, you know, we've been using internal combustion engines for now over 100 years. So the technology is very well developed relative to other technologies that are in the marketplace. And you have the inherent advantage that you're using this liquid hydrocarbon fuel that has a very high energy density. So you can carry a lot of energy along with you. And because we've been able to refine engines substantially, you can convert that energy to useful work at pretty high efficiency.
And I want to make sure people know how they can join in on the conversation with John Greenler and David Rothamer from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. What questions do you have about biofuels? Would you make an effort to buy or use something powered by them over something that's not? Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. And actually, Tim in Fort Collins has a question. Let's go to Tim. Hi, Tim.
Hi, I have a question for those fellows. First, I'd like to see if they would describe the concept of embodied energy within a fuel source, meaning how much energy did it take to put in to get that fuel source in order for you to get that fuel source, and the problems with that with ethanol and derived from crops, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, what is the current state of affairs for the embodied energy of current fuels we're going to use, or the fuels they're working on that they hope to commercialize someday, I'm sure.
Great. So basically, how much energy does it take to produce that energy, it sounds like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, one of the key issues with biofuels is really looking at the whole life cycle of the fuel from, you know, starting in the field with actually planting the seed or, you know, whatever you're actually going to grow to make the fuel, and then looking at all the energy inputs, whether it be, you know, the diesel fuel that was used in the tractor to do that planting, as well as the harvesting, looking at the transport then of the grain or corn stover or whatever biological material you're going to use, and then also accounting for the energy that's involved in the conversion process. And right now, with ethanol, it's one of its drawbacks is that the conversion process involves a very energy-intensive step, and that's the distillation process to basically separate the ethanol from the water. And so you need to account for all these different steps, then including that end transportation then of the fuel to the actual marketplace where it's going to be distributed mm-hmm. at the gas station.
And also, is there an issue of is there extra equipment that's needed in that process that might not be needed, and that's an extra cost both financially and in energy as well?
Yeah. When you kind of look at these calculations, there's always a big issue of where you draw the bound for what we would call the system. So, I mean, if you lots of times you actually also want to include, you know, how much energy did it take to manufacture the stainless steel that's used in the fermentation vessel that was used to produce the fuel, and how do you basically, you know, divide that up among the units of ethanol that you're going to produce. And so you have to take these things at a pretty big scope, and there's a lot of work within the GLBRC itself to address that, and we typically call that a life cycle assessment analysis.
And John, it seems like having people that are working across that whole spectrum of issues is where you could get really good information about what all those different inputs are.
What is one of the really exciting aspects of GLBRC that I really appreciate and value, and that is that we have this wide range of different types of researchers. And actually, just last week, we had our all-center retreat where there were 300-some researchers all together, and they range from economists to ecologists to people like Dave working on engines to people who are focusing on fermentation, focusing on this modeling aspect of how do we do all this kinds of accounting. And so, you know, to really have a really rich synergistic exchange of all these different ideas really allows us to comprehensively, you know, look at the whole system and make sure that we're not missing any pieces, that we really are looking at, you know, where are all these different inputs, what are the potential outputs, and how do we really, you know, work together to come up with something which is going to really function as a whole.
Thanks for that call, Tim. And let's go to Jim in Green Bay. Hi, Jim. Jim, are you there?
Hello. Is talking to Green Bay?
Yes.
Oh, hi. This question is for the mechanical engineer.
Yes.
Talking about engine types, I see these flex fuel engines on the market. And, you know, when you look at some of the parts that go into them, the standard engine and a flex fuel engine seem to have a lot of the same common parts. So my first main question is, what is truly different about a flex fuel engine than what we are using in our standard internal combustion engine? And I'll tell you my follow-up right away.
Okay.
You can address both, then I'll get off the phone. The anecdotal information is if you burn E85 gas in an internal combustion engine, mileage suffers significantly. So are we really doing any good when you have to use a lot more of it per cost, even though the cost is less for the gas? But, you know, the people I know who have them don't like to use them because of power issues and of course, lower economy.
Okay, and I'm going to have to cut you off there, Jim, but I'm going to ask David Rothamer to address that after we come back from the news. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back. Glad to have you with us today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and joining me are John Greenler and David Rothamer from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center here at UW-Madison. And when we went into the break, Jim had just asked a question about flex fuel. So why don't we go ahead and take care of that answer first off. David?
Yeah, well, Jim's question is actually a really good one, since there are quite a few vehicles now out there that are designated as flex fuel, and for those that don't know, that basically means that they can run E85 mixtures within the engine, which is 85% ethanol. And as Jim noted, if you actually look at the engine itself, you know, take one car, open up its hood, take another car, open up its hood, they look basically the same, and that's effectively because they are. So the interesting thing about flex fuel vehicles is that the amount of changes needed to actually run E85 are pretty small, and really they essentially amount to changing sealing materials within the engine in terms of the actual physical materials differences, because elastomeric materials, i.e. rubbers that are compatible with gasoline, are not necessarily compatible with ethanol. So they need to spend some money to upgrade those elastomers. And then another key difference is really on how the engine is what we would call calibrated, which you can kind of think of that as just how do they program the engine controller to decide how to set the spark timing and things of that nature. So basically a little bit of modification to how we run the engine. The other part of Jim's question was talking about really the cost difference with running something like E85, since the energy density of ethanol, if you look at the amount of energy per gallon that you actually are putting into your gas tank, is about 70% that of gasoline for E85. What ends up happening is that what you would expect to happen then is that your fuel economy would be only 70% of what you get with gasoline. And that doesn't necessarily need to be the case, because we can actually design engines to run a little bit better on ethanol than we can on gasoline. But because there's in the marketplace right now, since gasoline is the dominant fuel and most people aren't running E85 all the time, engines aren't optimized to do that. And that would actually add more cost into the engine to do that.
And actually, a follow-up to that, Gail in Madison emailed to say an earlier caller had asked about energy inputs to create biofuels. It seems like pumping, refining, and transporting oil or gas is obviously also energy intensive. So is there a comprehensive comparison taking inputs for both into account for each energy source, John?
Yeah, you really need to do that comparison. You need to have those kind of reference standards. And there are a lot of energy inputs, as you said, exactly, that are associated with petroleum-based fuels, you know, gasoline or diesel. And so, yeah, relative to what is really important. The other thing that gets even trickier, just to go a step further, is clearly the biofuels that we're working on at GLBRC are, we're not going to be seeing them for, you know, and there may be 10, 20, you know, some of the more advanced forms, maybe 30 or 40 years. And so we actually need to project forward in a parallel fashion for where the, you know, the petroleum fossil fuel industry is going to be. And it's very clear that they're going to become much more intensive as it gets harder and harder to extract that fuel, you know, from deeper wells or from shale or tar sands type sources. And so to really do a fair comparison, you need to kind of make sure that, you know, you're on the right time scale as well as kind of different types of fuel. So
I think you mentioned earlier that when you had a GLBRC gathering, there were economists there, and I think we see why that would be
yes.
important.
Oh, they're invaluable.
Thanks for that comment, Gail. And let's go to Rich in Prairie Farm. Hi, Rich.
A couple of questions, I guess. One about pine pitch. I know it's used for boilers as a fuel, but seems like there's quite an abundance of pine trees around. Might be able to make a fuel out of that. Then also nectar from trees, or not nectar, but sap from trees. A lot of trees have some sugar content in them, and it seems like you could collect that and make ethanol without killing the tree or refuse, you know, like wood scraps or whatever.
Thanks for that question, Rich. So maybe we'll be putting maple syrup in?
Well, it's always a possibility. There's the nice thing from the combustion perspective is most times I can respond and say, well, anything will burn, and if we can burn it, then we can get some useful work out of it. There's always lots of issues when you kind of target things that are, it seems like they're pretty abundant, but yet if you look at the bigger scale of fuels, they're actually relatively small. The interesting thing about the caller's question is that one of the key things that the GLBRC is actually working on is essentially trying to figure out how do you take biomass and make sugars. Right. And so that the sugars that we're talking about when we talk about sap from trees, those are kind of one of the intermediate products that we're actually trying to generate when we take, you know, the raw biomass, whether it be, you know, wood or crop residues, as we talked about earlier. We really are trying to convert that to sugar and then use those sugars to make a fuel.
Thanks for that, Colin. Let's go to Marcus in Hudson. Hi, Marcus.
Yeah. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep. Perfectly.
Okay. Good. I'm on speakerphone here. My question is, you know, why is it that we haven't used hemp industrially for biofuels? You know, it can grow anywhere. It doesn't need pesticides. You can use the entire plant. You know, I can maybe understand some of the military industrial complex reasons for why we haven't done this, but I mean, is this feasible? I want to get the experts' opinions on this.
Great question, Marcus. Thanks for calling.
I'll address this one too, and John can probably jump in as well. It's definitely a feasible thing, and it's effectively what we're pursuing at the GLBRC. So hemp is a has a high concentration of cellulose, and essentially the GLBRC, a main focus is to look at how do we deconstruct that cellulosic material to make these sugars that I was talking about. And then the next step is how do we convert that to fuels? And really this kind of focuses around the key issue of what we call recalcitrance of this cellulosic material. And really what that means is that it's very, very hard to deconstruct the cellulose into these individual monomer sugars. And so there's a large part of the effort at GLBRC is focused on that process of breaking down these polymers, which cellulose is, down into the sugar monomers.
Yeah, so Dave is definitely correct. I mean, we could make, a high-quality biofuel from hemp. It has that fibrous aspect to it, all this cellulosic material. I think the question, that we ask ourselves, though, is, what are going to be the best crops in terms of sustainability? And this is a very large area in terms of these biofuel cropping systems. And hemp, I think we could probably get a pretty good yield from hemp. I actually haven't seen those numbers, but that would be my guess. But then the other dimensions that I think maybe make hemp not so good are the fact that it's an annual crop to start out with. And so each year you actually need to go in and you need to replant, which means disturbing the soil, a lot of energy inputs to maintain that type of a crop, much like the way we have to grow corn as an annual on a yearly basis. When we're looking at fibrous material, there's the opportunity to grow a lot of plants that are actually perennial, where you would plant them once and then you would be able to harvest them on an annual basis for a very extended period of time. And so a good example of that that probably a number of listeners have heard of is switchgrass. It's a native species that is, is very productive in terms of producing this above-ground fibrous material. But it also has this perennial root system, which overwinters. And so in addition to not having to replant all those inputs, that root system, which is so extensive with switchgrass, actually does a couple different things. One is it actually holds the soil in place, and it even really builds soil, goes that additional step, because the organic material that's associated with that roots really kind of, in essence, is what made the prairie soils that we have today. When we look at issues like climate change, this is really a significant opportunity, because all those roots are composed of carbon that once was CO2 in the atmosphere. And so we're sequestering carbon out of the atmosphere and back into the soil. So we really have the opportunity to some extent to actually, reverse the greenhouse gas emissions that are so much a part of our transportation system today.
Well, and I know just from my own little garden that the native plants do a lot better, with the prevailing climate changes, and when I forget to water them or they don't need a lot of fertilizer, they're just hardy. And so using a native crop, whether it's annual or perennial, seems like that would be a great way to go.
Yeah, they're very efficient, and irrigation is a key issue. Water use is really significant, and I think it's clear this will become increasingly important. And the roots of switchgrass, they're known to go 30 feet in the ground, and so when that the surface of the soil is drying up, the switchgrass can really tap into deep reserves.
They don't even notice. Bob.
Yeah, and the same is true for a lot of nutrients. So nitrogen, for example, right, which is very energy intensive. So we're much more efficient in terms of our energy in versus the energy out. That gets back to that life cycle assessment they were talking about earlier.
That's really exciting. And I think Zach has in La Crosse has a similar question along those lines. Hi, Zach.
Hi. Yeah, I'd just like our guests to comment along the same lines about the need to switch to a sustainable perennial production of these biofuels. And I'd just like to hear what sort of research and projects and trials are out on the ground and how they see accommodating this new up-and-coming generation of farmers that are seeking to address these needs.
Great. Thanks a lot, Zach.
Yeah, this is an area that we're really extensively involved in, and we have trials that are in the ground on a number of different scales. We have at Arlington Research Station just north of Madison, actually also at the Kellogg Biological Station on the other side of Lake Michigan, we have replicated plots where we're really looking at about 8 or 9 different types of cropping systems and looking at a number of different variables. How much biomass can we get out? What kind of nutrient input inputs are required, and then correspondingly, what kind of environmental concerns are there in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, not just carbon dioxide, but also methane and nitrogen type emissions-based emissions as well, water use, all these different things. But then we actually have other trials which are scaled up, looking more at the field scale, and once again, we can get a very good idea at that point in time in terms of greenhouse gas fluxes both in and out of these types of systems. And then we get to the point of being able to look at things like biodiversity, what types of beneficial insects might be associated with these crops as well. And then we actually then move into a modeling type process where we use very sophisticated computer technology to say, okay, if we have this kind of data, what might this look like if we broadly deploy these new types of cropping systems on a regional scale or even on a national scale, so we can really get a good idea before we really commit to something as to whether or not it's going to really have the advantages that we hope in terms of these new types of crops.
And I want to let people know that we're talking with John Greenler and David Rothamer of the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center here on the UW-Madison campus. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today, and we'd love to have you join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Carly Younger is answering the phones today, and she'll be happy to get you in line. Let's go to Daniel in Wanawak. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I was just wanted to ask about methane generators, if they work on stuff like that, and about vehicles that run LP gas and what kind of engines they use. That's all I needed to ask.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks, Daniel. So there's a number of ways in which methane gets used, and it kind of depends on the scale of the engine that we're talking about. So there's some projects, that are looking at very, very large-scale methane collection, such as manure digesters and things of that nature, which is very relevant for Wisconsin, as well as there's actually what we call landfill gas, which is highly enriched in methane as well, which is basically decomposition of materials in landfills. And those tend to be very similar to our regular diesel engines for those very large scale usages of methane. And they're somewhat modified from a regular diesel engine, but the bones are effectively that of a diesel engine. In terms of talking about compressed natural gas or liquid propane, essentially for transportation purposes, if we look at actual cars, for those cases, we would be running basically a spark ignition engine, very similar to actually what's currently out there. And there's not a huge amount of modification that needs to be done. It mainly relates to the fuel system, the injectors, and obviously the storage of the compressed natural gas on the vehicle.
Thanks for that call. David, as I'm listening to you talk about really two different sides of this, it seems like you need to take at least two big variables into account in your work: how biofuels may develop, and also what innovations might occur in engine design and how those will work together or not. How do you do that, and how do you project forward in those two different veins?
Yeah, it's kind of a difficult problem, actually, because you have these two, really a near-term perspective that you need to take and then a long-term perspective. So we need to be working on new engine technologies that are going to push the engine efficiency that might not be implemented for another 20 years, depending upon how the research progresses. And then we also need to look at, how are we going to implement biofuels into our current fuel infrastructure? And so some of the work that I'm doing with the GLBR C is really focused on how do we design what I would call green gasoline fuels that look very similar to current gasoline, but unlike ethanol, really could be considered a drop-in replacement, meaning that you need no modification to the engine to run that particular fuel.
So you're really using models to project out both things, because also you might know that engines are going to develop in a certain way and biofuels are probably going to develop in a certain way, but are they going to reach the right point at the same time for you to put them together?
Yeah, and that's one of the real difficulties, is that there's a lot of interest in trying to develop specific biofuels to work with specific engines. And kind of the key constraint to this whole problem is economics, is that we need to have something that at very, very large scale, you know, is very economical so that it can be cost competitive with gasoline from both the perspective of the engine and the fuel itself. And so it's kind of balancing, you know, okay, what's actually technically feasible versus what's economically feasible.
Rick in New London would like to join in, so let's go to Rick. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question is, have you ever thought of harvesting invasive plants such as buckthorn and other things? You know, I do forestry work, and it's a pain in the neck. If we could find a way to get to limit its growth and use it as a biofuel, that would be great.
If you ever start experiments on Creeping Charlie, I would be happy to provide you with the first badge.
Well, definitely feel your pain there in terms of harvesting buckthorn. That's hard work to do, or garlic mustard this time of year is really coming on strong. So understand. I think there's definitely the possibility of being able to use that type of biomass. One of the challenges is, as we look at, you know, these types of materials, these cellulosic materials, is it takes a fair bit of tuning, at least at this point, in the process of conversion to go from one type of biomass to another. And so, you know, I think as the technology improves, we might be able to come up with a more versatile system so we could, you know, put lots of different types of biomass into a biorefinery to make, you know, future generation biofuels. I think, and I really appreciate you raising the issue of invasive species, because one of the things that's really important for us is to look at crops that we might be planting and making sure that they're really not, you know, of this type of nature, that we don't have species that we would be planting that would be invasive, that really could cause problems, you know, in our landscape. And so this is something that's another, you know, significant area of concern. So reed canary grass, for example, really easy to plant. You can get a lot of biomass, but boy, it can really take over and cause a lot of problems.
And so, certainly there are histories of things that were introduced with the best of intentions.
Sure
that
are,
now we're
right.
trying to get rid of.
So as I mentioned earlier, like with switchgrass, that's one of the things that's really exciting about it, is it is a native species, so we're working really, you know, with
right.
the system that's local for us.
Thanks for that question, Rick. And let's go to Tom in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I have, you know, you're going through and comparing the various potential sources of material and the complexity of getting the biochemistry to work so you get the sugar you want to work with. And obviously, if you have something that's nearby, like corn, like stover you mentioned, you know, that might be an asset, you know, for a lot of reasons. But oftentimes, switchgrass comes into the conversation, and I'm curious, is there some particular reason? Do we have the technology to do that right now? Do we have the technology to do the corn stover right now? Is one more complex than the other? And essentially, you know, you're trying to find a concentrated source nearby without the transportation costs. The corn is here right now. And what would it take to even begin to get fields of switchgrass that would compare in the biomass that's already out there every year with corn?
Great. Thanks for that question, Tom.
That's a really astute question. I'm always really impressed by, you know, the considerations that the callers have. And you're definitely right. You know, corn stover, it's available, it's here, and it's plentiful, and it's really one of our primary, you know, targets in terms of looking at this kind of, this complex conversion process. I think the interest in switchgrass, and I haven't really elucidated on this earlier, is that there are areas that we call marginal lands where, for example, you wouldn't be able to plant an annual crop like corn, which in fact can be very productive as a perennial system, and switchgrass is a really good candidate for that. So if we were looking at planting additional crops, or if we were looking at crops that we would want to place in our agricultural landscape that would buffer, for example, our waterways from runoff, we could be planting switchgrass, much as if you're familiar with the Conservation Reserve Program, the CRP program at this point in time, but also get the additional benefit of being able to take some biomass, you know, from those plantings to then be able to make biofuel as well. So it's really, they're complementary. It's not necessarily an either-or type of situation.
Thanks for that call, Tom. And Billy in Duluth, let's get you on. Hi, Billy.
Hi. I was wondering, there was an article a while back where out of the Polytech Institute in New York, and they made a bioplastic for the government, which afterwards they could add water and a yeast to, and it could be converted into a usable biodiesel. And I was just wondering if there's any opportunities developing in the future for that sort of sequential design.
Thanks.
Yeah, bioplastics is an interesting area, and I think one of the things we recognize in GLBRC is there's going to be opportunities that will come out of our research that may not go directly into fuels. It actually might go into other industrial areas, such as plastics, for example. I want to come back to, in some ways, where we start off in terms of the life cycle assessment consideration, and it's interesting. We actually have some people in GLBRC who in previous domains of research, have actually been very involved in bioplastics, and one of the things that frequently turns up is it takes a lot of energy to make bioplastics. And in some cases, you have to use more energy to make a bioplastic that essentially the energy inputs negate the fact that you're actually starting with a biological material to make that plastic. But I think your question also raises the point about once we have that kind of plastic, how can it be recycled? And I think, once again, you know, the more robust and durable, adaptable the technologies are, the more we might be able to put a wide range of different types of materials, you know, into this type of refining to produce a biofuel.
Well, as always, lots of great topics of conversation and lots of great questions from our callers. Talking today with John Greenler and David Rothamer, both associated with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center at UW-Madison. David, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks a lot, Judith.
And John, thanks as always for lighting up a great program.
A pleasure.
And I just want to let you know that Larry will be back tomorrow, so we hope you'll stay tuned here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Linda Stout proved through her award-winning work in Appalachia that diversity is essential to meaningful social change. Now she's helping groups around the country begin their work by getting everybody a seat at the table. I'm Jean Faraca. Join us for How to Make It Happen, Collective Visioning, today at 3 here on Earth.
Supporters of WPR include Dottie Dumplings Dowry, a family-owned business in downtown Madison for over 30 years. Dottie's offers a variety of gourmet hamburgers, fresh salads, homemade soup, chili,